You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest talks about his study on whether allowing wolf hunting is good for species management.
But first, amid budget cuts, weakened tenure protections, and a chilly atmosphere between UW and faculty and staff and Governor Walker, some of the UW system's faculty have been looking for jobs elsewhere or receiving offers from other universities.
Last week, we spoke with a professor who is leaving the UW, and now our next guest is making the case for why faculty should stay at the university. David Cannon is a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Madison. David, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, we've been seeing opinion pieces running in the papers from professors who say that in some part they're happy to leave UW-Madison behind. They point to hostility between faculty and the legislature and changes to tenure protections. You are saying the opposite, that you're happy staying put at UW-Madison. Why?
Well, yes, and it has been a challenging year, and there's no doubt about that. And chairs, in every department in the university have faced challenges in trying to, retain their faculty. But this is still a great public university, and it's still a fantastic place to live. And in our department, the political science department, we have a great group of collegial folks who get along with each other and collaborate on research, and it's just a very good place to get your work done. We have fantastic students. So there's still a lot of positive things about this university, despite the challenges that we're facing right now.
And has the political science department lost any of its faculty or staff who decided to go elsewhere, been lured away?
We have. And it was a year that we saw a lot more retention activity than we normally do. We had 10 of my colleagues in the department of 35 people who had outside interest, and we were able to retain 8 of those 10, but we did lose 2. And university-wide, it was a very active retention year as well. The numbers as of this afternoon, there were 94 people in the university who had outside interest. 86 of those have been resolved so far, and 76 people out of those 86 decided to stay. So that's about 88% are staying. And so we hear a lot about the 12% who are leaving, but we haven't heard the success story, which is we have had a strong year in retention. Given that the numbers are about triple in terms of the number of people who we had to try to retain this year, in the previous fiscal year, it was a total of 37, and this year it was 94. So it's more than double the number of people that other universities are pursuing. And we, again, have been successful in 88% of those cases so far.
Are you anticipating, or are you maybe already seeing those numbers starting to taper off, or are you not sure that there's going to be an end anytime soon?
Well, that's a really good question. And, we're hoping, obviously, we won't have another year like this one in terms of this level of activity, because the university did devote substantial resources to try to retain people, and that's one reason we were so successful, I think, is that the vice chancellor for research and graduate education, the chancellor, the deans, all were very active in trying to retain people and put resources behind it. So we really would have a tough time if we had another year or two like this with this level of retention activity, because it is a very costly process to keep people that are being wooed by other universities.
So I'm curious about the behind-the-scenes aspect of this. You mentioned deans being involved, and you're painting it from a largely a financial perspective. Is that the main tool for keeping faculty here? Are there also, colleagues sitting down with colleagues saying, look, I think you should stay? Have you had those conversations with people?
Oh, absolutely. No, there's a lot on the more personal side that I think makes a big difference. And you spend a lot of time as chair and with your colleagues, talking to them and trying to convince them to stay. And I think that, obviously you need to be able to try your best as an institution to match the outside offers as well. But I think it is the collegial nature, the personal side of things that can make a big difference to people's decision to end up staying here.
We're talking with David Cannon right now, a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Madison, talking about faculty retention efforts at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and looking at what are the main critiques about colleagues leaving. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is one primary example of this. The weakening of tenure protections, as some faculty see it, is one reason that's been cited as a main cause for professors deciding to set up shop somewhere else. How do you reassure your colleagues about that when you're trying to convince them to stay?
Well, one thing is to point out what our peer institutions are doing. And, in fact, Dean Schultz mentioned this in one of his recent meetings with chairs, where he said that we were in the process of trying to retain someone at an offer at the University of Pennsylvania, a private institution. And this person was, you know, raising questions about tenure. And the dean said, well, you know, check out what Penn has. And they have, you know, much weaker protections for tenure than we do. And so Wisconsin went from having probably the strongest tenure protections in the country, you know, guaranteed in statute, and it was something that, you know, no other public university had. And so the changes that were made, you know, largely made us the same as most of our peer institutions. I mean, there are, you know, areas of concern going forward where we don't know exactly how this is going to play out, but it has made us comparable to our peer institutions. And so I think that is an important thing to keep in mind, that, you know, while the tenure standards and protections were weakened, there's no doubt about that. It just made us, you know, more like our peer institutions rather than stronger.
What would you say to parents who are concerned about sending their children here because there is acrimony between faculty and staff at the university and the legislature and the governor? And what if a parent is worried about sending their child here and having it impact their kids' education?
One thing, I spend a lot of time as chair talking to alumni groups. I've taken at least 5 or 6 trips every year and go around the country and talk to alumni groups. And this question has come up about, you know, the relations between the university and the state legislature, and especially this question of retention. You know, are we, you know, losing good people? And one thing I point out on the latter point is that the fact that so many universities are coming after our professors is actually a sign of our strengths, and that, you know, that we have such great faculty here that other universities are trying to recruit them. And I, you know, tell my colleagues all the time that, you know, I see this as a signal that we are, you know, doing good research, and we're, you know, at the top of our game. To have, you know, 10 of our colleagues being recruited in 1 year show that we do have, you know, really excellent faculty, and the fact that we're able to retain 88% of them is a good sign. And so I would be worried, in fact, as chair, if nobody was ever trying to recruit our people. It would mean that we weren't doing cutting edge research. And so I think this is a positive sign overall. Now, on the other hand, it certainly is troubling to not have better relations with the state legislature and with the governor. And I think that is something that the chancellor is keenly aware of and is continuing to work on all the time. And it's something that, you know, the leadership of the university is definitely cognizant of.
And we leave it there. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
David Cannon is a professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Madison.
Now, a recent study from a UW professor questions a long-held belief that allowing the public to hunt large carnivores or having the government sponsor culling of those carnivores can be a valuable part of species management.
The study looked at how wolf hunting in Wisconsin and Michigan over the last 20 years related to the animal's population numbers. Researchers found that even though officials argue hunting seasons lead to less poaching, that may not be true.
Adrian Trevis joins us now. He's one of the authors of this study. He's an associate professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison and founder of the Carnivore Coexistence Lab. Adrian, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Rob.
Well, tell us about this study. What were you trying to find out? What did you find out?
Well, I mean, we were contracted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to answer a question that mm-hmm. they had posed in court in 2006. They had argued in federal court that they needed to be able to give permits to the states to cull wolves in order to improve tolerance for wolves, in order to reduce poaching of wolves, in order to help conserve and recover the gray wolves of Michigan and Wisconsin. The judge rejected that argument based on things unrelated to our research. And 4 years later, the Fish and Wildlife Service asked us to examine that question scientifically. Does, in fact, culling wolves reduce poaching?
And that's kind of the state of the art. That's the assumption in a lot of conservation programs here in the U.S., in other countries, that allowing some measure of culling, maybe hunting or whatever form that takes, is going to reduce poaching and make people more tolerant of a wolf or other predator.
Exactly, Rob. I mean, the assumption is that poachers will refrain if there's legal recourse, if the government is handling the issue.
Well, let's talk about who the poachers are. I mean, it's when I think of poaching, I guess I think of somebody doing it recreationally almost, but we might include in that poaching category a farmer who's had depredations from wolves or fears that. Is that who we're talking about in that poaching category too?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's anybody who would illegally take wildlife. Mm-hmm. We're calling a poacher for simplicity. And when we're talking about government culling, we're talking about when a government agent has a permit to kill a protected species. And they usually did that with wolves after verified livestock losses or perceived threats to humans. Safety, although there haven't been any attacks on people by wild wolves in Wisconsin and Michigan in recorded history, there were occasional perceived threats that led to this culling of wolves.
So again, the idea, government culling makes people more tolerant, reduces the risk of poaching. So how in this study do you try to find out if that's true?
Okay, well, the first thing we did is we looked at the wolf population growth when there was culling and when there wasn't culling. And the unique thing about Wisconsin and Michigan is both states went through 12 periods, 6 periods with culling authority and 6 periods without culling authority. So we were able to track wolf population growth and the change in that growth rate over those 12 periods. When we discovered that wolf population growth had diminished by an average of 4% every time the state had authority to cull wolves, we then tried to look at the 3 possible reasons why a population growth rate would decline. And there are only 3 real reasons. Either wolves migrated out of the states of Wisconsin and Michigan, which actually doesn't make sense because what we found was an association with policy signals. That means communications from the government. And there's no known mechanism for wolves to migrate out of the state when the government announces something. The other option is a much more plausible alternative, and it's called density dependence. And that occurs in a lot of wildlife populations when the population reaches a certain abundance or certain density, and things like birth rate are reduced. We eliminated that possibility by analyzing the breeding success of wolf packs in Wisconsin over the time period in question, which was 1995 to 2012. And we actually found that packs bred more successfully over time. So if anything, we're underestimating the slowdown in population growth. And that left our third possibility, that a new source of mortality had emerged. And this is what a lot of people aren't understanding from the study, even academics who criticized us. We were just looking for a new source of mortality that could respond to a policy signal that could destroy radio collars, because some of the wolves that disappeared had radio collars that just stopped transmitting, and a source of mortality that's difficult to detect. And that occurs with poaching because people hide the evidence, you know, shoot, shovel, and shut up. So basically, we inferred that poaching was responsible because it's the only thing that fits all of those characteristics.
Well, maybe a dumb question, but I mean, if there's culling going on, is it culling to an extent, a government-led shooting of the wolves, that it would bring down those populations or lower that population growth to the extent that you found?
That's an excellent question, Rob, and that was the first thing we looked at. Well, I mean, was the state actually culling enough wolves, right, to slow down the population growth? And it turns out, no, they weren't killing enough. They typically kill a small number of wolves in those situations I described previously. And so what we found was when you take into account how many wolves they're removing, it doesn't explain the rather dramatic slowdown in population growth that we detected. Think of it as about a quarter of the population growth in the 2 states was eliminated every time there was culling authority. And then keep in mind that they don't always cull wolves when they have that authority. The two events are decoupled from each other in many ways.
Talking to Adrian Trevis from UW-Madison about his new study on the impact of culling of wolves on the population of those predators. So then what you're saying is when culling is on, when the government is shooting some wolves, what, that sends a signal to potential poachers?
Exactly. It seems to be sending a signal that either wolves have less value or that anti-poaching rules won't be enforced. And we're thinking that these poachers, whom we don't know who they are, but we're thinking that these poachers are saying to themselves, well, if the government's doing it, I can do it, and I can probably do it better. So the poachers are actually killing more wolves in their localities than anything close to what the government was culling. And the reasons for that are unclear because we don't have any research on poachers. But what the take-home message is pretty clear for the government: stop culling until you understand this pattern and process. because it's way out of proportion to the problem that they purport to fix by culling wolves.
You mentioned that poaching is a crime that's hard to detect. It's a law that can be hard to enforce. Do we have numbers, though? Are there significant enough numbers in either state or in other countries that we can try to use that data?
Yeah, so stay posted or have me on the show again later this year when our paper on this subject comes out. But we can also point to studies in other places, from Alaska to Sweden, even in the Yellowstone area. We're starting to get indications that poaching is the most severe form of mortality for large carnivores like wolves and grizzly bears, and that the majority of this poaching is never reported. It's what we call cryptic poaching. So one study from Sweden in particular, I'll cite, by Ulf Lieberg and his colleagues, showed that over just about 51% of all mortality was poaching, and two-thirds of that was this cryptic or hidden poaching that was never reported.
Now, we've been talking about government-led culling. We've been talking about illegal poaching. There's a third method here, government-issued hunting licenses. Is there a potential that that could be an outlet? Maybe the people who would be poaching are instead getting that license, participating in a government-led program, and then the numbers would work out better.
That's precisely right, Rob. You hit the nail on the head. It's possible that public hunting and trapping are different. We looked at the evidence back in 2009. We didn't find any evidence. So what I want to encourage the government to do is to study these questions before declaring large-scale policy changes, because we really don't know what the consequences of public hunting and trapping are for poaching of these large carnivores. And they're all on the brink of recovery. And some of them are, again, at risk of local extinction. So we need to be careful. And we're encouraging the government to take care whenever it's killing, because blood doesn't seem to buy goodwill.
You mentioned being on the brink of recovery. Some people have been saying we need to allow the hunt. It's time to allow a hunt or allow culling because they are recovered. They're in numbers large enough to sustain themselves. We've talked to you about this, I think, or one of your colleagues in the past who said, no, we're not there yet.
Right. I don't feel we're there yet. We wrote a letter to Congress. 70 scientists and scholars joined me in that letter, arguing that not only have wolves in the Great Lakes region not reached the legal definition of recovery, biologically the evidence is not there. The evidence about human attitudes to wolves does not line up with the decision to delist. And generally what the federal government has argued is, trust us, trust the states. Wolves can be managed wisely off of the endangered species list. Well, this most recent paper was an examination of this whole idea of trusting the government that culling would reduce poaching. We're just not finding the evidence, so we're a lot more skeptical about these government claims.
So you're making the case, don't cull, don't have a wolf hunt at this point, it sounds like. Before I go on, is that right?
Yeah, until we understand much more.
Okay, and then what? What do we need to look at to understand more before we set a new policy?
Well, listen, I think we need a transparent scientific accounting for wildlife because they're public trust assets. The public trust doctrine is over 200 years old. It's supported by the U.S. Constitution, by the state constitution. It's supported by U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And it has a very inspirational message. The public trust doctrine says the government is accountable to us, to current and future generations, for preserving and regulating the use of these wildlife that are assets. And I think about future generations and the message we're sending to them about the legacy that we want to pass on. And I think we want a healthy, vibrant nature to pass on to our children and to their children. And at the moment, we have a really confusing mix of policies, no clear scientific accounting, and the government is not acting as a prudent trustee, in my opinion.
We've heard arguments against the public trust doctrine lately in terms of water and high-capacity wells. The state legislature saying the way we're doing it now, we're allowing unelected bureaucrats to make decisions that affect people. They want to see more of the power in the hands of the legislature to do things like set rules and Governor Walker's administration. Are you worried about an erosion of the public trust doctrine, whether we're talking about water or wolves?
There are a lot of challenges to the public trust right now. all three branches of government are needed to support and enforce and recognize the public trust doctrine. So putting it all in the hands of the legislature would centralize a little too much power. I want all three branches of government active in an ethical and prudent way, in the way that our founding fathers envisioned it, checks and balances. And in this case, the judiciary plays an incredibly powerful and important role in defending our Constitution and our laws. And sometimes the legislature needs to be checked, and that's the role of the judiciary.
Well, getting back to wolves and your study in particular, you've put the study out, you've made this case. Do you get a feeling from the response you've seen that the people who are making these decisions are paying attention?
Well, we're getting an extremely positive response from the public. There's, of course, criticism and some people who are really married to these ideas that have very little evidence, like blood buys goodwill. They're responding negatively, but we, you know, we expected that. And so far, the nationwide media and the public have responded positively, so we're optimistic.
Adrian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. It's been a pleasure.
That was UW Professor Adrian Trevis talking about his study on wolf culling and poaching in Wisconsin and Michigan. The Associated Press is reporting that a small number of unbound delegates have pledged their support now for Donald Trump, allowing him to reach the necessary 1,237 delegates needed to secure the nomination of the Republican Party.
This happens the same time that Donald Trump has made some disparaging remarks about fellow Republicans and as House Speaker Paul Ryan is still refusing to endorse him.
Joining us now to discuss the news and the race is Michael Bender. He writes about American politics for Bloomberg Politics in Washington. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi there.
Well, we knew this number, it looked like it was going to be met sometime and probably sometime soon. Some people thought maybe not until June, but now Donald Trump has hit that magic number that we've been talking about so long. Is that just symbolic or does it change something in his candidacy now?
Well, we will see if it changes anything in his candidacy. Nothing has really changed him so far, the way he's operated. And you're right to point out the context in this. Him reaching 1237, having officially enough delegates to be the Republican nominee, is not surprising in the last couple of weeks. But it is quite remarkable if you think even just a couple of months or 6 months back. But even a couple of months, this was something that a lot of people didn't think he would be able to reach until an open convention in Cleveland. So it's pretty remarkable that he's able to secure this now before the end of May. It gives him a talking point. You know, he attempted a sort of a victory lap today in North Dakota where he's campaigning. He had a press conference. He stood in front of a bunch of delegates from North Dakota who had flipped their allegiance to him in order to push him over 1237. But even that, he just couldn't help himself, right? I mean, this was less of a victory lap and more of the sort of same attacks we've come to expect from Trump, even within his own party. You know, he refused to back away from attacks on New Mexico's Republican governor, Susana Martinez. And, you know, she's obviously from two constituencies he's doing terrible with, women and Hispanics. So the unity in the Republican Party still has a ways to go. He definitely expects Republicans to come to him and is showing little interest in extending an olive branch out to any of his former rivals or their supporters.
Right. You mentioned Susana Martinez. Now, he was in New Mexico this week. This is a Republican woman, as you mentioned, a Latina. She's prominent in the Republican Governors Association, a key spender in a lot of races around the country. Here's Donald Trump talking about, again, this is a Republican governor. Here he is.
Since 2000, the number of people on food stamps in New Mexico has tripled. We have to get your governor to get going. She's got to do a better job, okay? Your governor has got to do a better job. She's not doing the job. Hey, maybe I'll run for governor of New Mexico. I'll get this place going.
Now, it sounds like what you'd say about the person you're campaigning against in an election, not a potential ally in your own party. Now, potential, she didn't appear with him at this event. She's been critical of him, says she wouldn't be bullied into supporting a candidate who didn't line up with her views. But, wow, the big story here is how much can Republicans rally around Donald Trump? Comments like that, obviously, and you were suggesting this, can't make it easy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the calculation here for Trump has to be, well, part of it has got to be his own ego here, and he's been successful, and business and so far in politics acting just like this and launching these sort of attacks. But also this type of rhetoric just reinforces his own brand as well, that he's not going to be captive to any special interests. Like, you know, he won't even play nice with people within his own party. So it helps reinforce that image, which you know, a lot of people like, but it's just hard to imagine how anyone can win the presidency without the support within their own party, right? I mean, we're a 50-50 nation here, and getting over the top, they're getting 51%, so to speak. You need to have all of your own, pins lined up here before you can sort of look to capture new supporters.
I want to stay on this theme for a moment of Donald Trump's attacks on other Republicans. Here he was earlier this week. Talk about Mitt Romney saying that Mitt Romney had choked in the election and he'd done it then and would do it again. Here's a listen.
He's a choker. And you know the truth? I hate to say it. I hope we don't have too many in the audience. Once a choker, always a choker. And I was nasty about it. So now, as retribution, Donald Trump shouldn't run, pa, pa, pa. And he walks like a penguin onto the stage. You ever seen? Like a penguin.
Like a penguin, Jerry. It almost sounds like a Seinfeld clip here. You say, is this Donald Trump's personality or is this a calculated persona that has worked so far and he thinks is going to keep on working?
I think it's a little bit of both, right? I mean, this is definitely his personality, part of his personality. He's a New Yorker through and through. He's a child, if not a creation of the New York tabloid culture. He promoted that himself as a young man. He knows how to play this game, and it's deeper than just and goes back further than just his own experience as a reality TV show host. I mean, definitely part of the calculation here is to dominate headlines, right? And even in the primary, when he got in trouble, when the heat started getting turned up a little bit too high, he'd back away, not by apologizing or distancing himself from comments, but creating some new forest fire somewhere that everyone's attention turned to. So, this is definitely the game here, and one that Hillary Clinton and her team is desperately trying to figure out and figure out how to counter. Mitt Romney will probably not be someone who will endorse Trump the rest of the year. I say that as quite an understatement. Jeb Bush, you can include in there. I will say today, the news in Washington, Marco Rubio said that he will support Trump. He won't and would be willing to speak at the convention. So, you're going to start to see some of this, some Republicans who, without any, who will sort of capitulate to Trump here, and without Trump having to change his tone, change his message, certainly not double back on any of his policies.
We're talking to Bloomberg politics reporter Michael Bender about the news that Donald Trump has reached the number of delegates, according to an AP count, that he needed to clinch the Republican nomination for president.
And we're going to continue our conversation, and we want to hear from you. Are you ready to support Republican candidate Donald Trump as a nominee if you're a conservative voter? And do you think the Republican Party will be able to unite now?